Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
And I just hope that the West of the world will keep on recognising that what Hong Kong represents is really important and fundamental to all of us.
As China marks 25 years since the handover of Hong Kong, Britain's last governor there, Chris Patten, tells me why he thinks the West let Hong Kong down. Then. A young artist at the height of her powers, Bianca Goladriga speaks with indie rock star and best-selling author Michelle Zorner of Japanese Breakfast. Plus, as extreme weather continues to wreak havoc around the world, Professor Christy Ebi tells Hari Srinivasan how we can improve our response to the climate crisis. Welcome to the programme, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. And when Britain handed Hong Kong back to China 25 years ago, ending more than 150 years of colonial rule, the city was set to be governed under the one country, two systems model, allowing it to retain democracy and freedom of speech, unlike in mainland China. But it wasn't long before Beijing started chipping away at that promise. In a moment, my interview with Britain's last governor of Hong Kong. But first, correspondent Christy Lou Stout looks at what's left of the territory's autonomy.
The Sino-British relations.
After Margaret Thatcher reached a deal with the Chinese on the return of Hong Kong, a local reporter took the Iron Lady to task.
You signed an agreement with China promising to deliver over 5 million people into the hands of a communist dictatorship.
Thatcher claimed mostly everyone in Hong Kong was happy with the deal and told Emily Lau,
"You may be a solitary exception."
So what do you make of that answer today in 2022?
Many of the journalists who subsequently stood up, they asked similar questions. So even in that room, I wasn't a solitary exception.
July 1, 2022 marks exactly halfway through 50 years of the one country, two systems autonomy Beijing promised to Hong Kong at the 1997 handover. It aims to preserve the city's freedoms of expression and assembly, as well as its institutions, including an independent judiciary.
But in the wake of the 2019 protests, pressure on the city's freedoms intensified thanks to a new national security law. Supporters say the law ended the chaos of 2019 and restored order, but it did more than that. Scenes of mass protests like this are no more. At least 186 people have been arrested under the law, including a 90-year-old Catholic cardinal. The opposition is virtually wiped out, with many of the city's pro-democracy figures in jail or exile. Politically charged artworks like the Pillar of Shame Tiananmen Memorial have been removed. Dozens of civil society groups, including the city's largest independent trade union, have disbanded. And national security investigations have led to the shuttering of news outlets like the Apple Daily. When asked about charges of diminished freedoms, a Hong Kong government spokesman told CNN, "Many freedoms and rights are not absolute and can be restricted for reasons including protection of national security and public safety." So, as former security chief John Lee prepares to lead the city from July 1, what is left of Hong Kong's promised autonomy?
We have autonomy in religion, in education, in media, including social media, in the internet, in how we manage our civil service. The second system is still here. It is functioning. It's under stress.
We want Hong Kong to be free.
Lau has always been a skeptic of one country, two systems, as a reporter, a lawmaker, and former chair of the Democratic Party.
I will not say that one country, two system is completely finished. The fact that I can stand here in the Democratic Party office to talk to you shows there's some freedom. And there are some differences, but they are getting less and less.
Lau says she is staying in the city to support her friends and colleagues in prison, abiding by her mantra,
"Be bold, be wise, and be careful."
Emily Lau speaking to Christy Lou Stout there. President Xi Jinping ventured outside mainland China for the first time since the start of the pandemic to visit Hong Kong on this 25th anniversary, burnishing his own view of success there.
Over the past few years, Hong Kong has withstood one severe test after another and overcome one risk and challenge after another. After weathering the storms, Hong Kong has emerged from the ashes with vigorous vitality.
Critics say Hong Kong has become virtually a police state, and we should note that journalists from several international media organizations like Reuters and CNN were blocked from covering Xi's trip. As the last governor in Hong Kong, Chris Patten said that Britain had provided, quote, the scaffolding that enabled the people there to ascend.
I have no doubt that with people here holding on to these values which they cherish, Hong Kong's star will continue to climb. Hong Kong's values are decent values. They are universal values.
And he's written about his experience in a new book called The Hong Kong Diaries. I started by asking him about his feelings as he handed over the reins. Lord Chris Patten, welcome back to our program.
Nice to be with you again.
So let me take you back 25 years. Today is the anniversary of the handover. You were governor of Hong Kong then. I just want to read something you sent back to London. I have relinquished the administration of this government. God save the Queen, Patten. Concise? What were your emotions then?
They were a lot less concise than that. I was leaving a city I loved. I was leaving some really great friends. My family ditto, because they'd loved it, and my wife, who was the real hero of my time there, had loved it as well. I felt very emotional about whether Hong Kong would be able to survive as it had, as a great international financial city, an extraordinary combination of economic freedom and political freedom. I hoped that that would all be true. And on the whole, the Chinese leadership at the time seemed to be slowly relaxing the communist grip on every aspect of life in China. So I guess we all hoped that that would be true for Hong Kong as well.
So let me ask you, with the fullness of time and the way you've just sort of, you know, contextualized your hopes at the time, was it more of a hope than a kind of a certainty? I mean, I don't want to say Pollyannish, but do you think Britain just put too much hope in the idea that communist China would honor for 50 years, which they said they would, the one country, two systems?
Well, my biggest critic in Hong Kong on the British side was a retired diplomat who was a great expert on China, but a rather vain and vain guy who didn't accept that anybody else had a point of view which was worth considering. And he actually tended to think of Hong Kong rather than Hong Kongers. And the kernel of his arguments about Hong Kong was looking at the Chinese leadership. He would say, they may be thuggish dictators, but they're men of their word. Well, we now know that part of that is true. And for some time, they reasonably clearly kept to the main points of the international treaty we'd signed with them and kept to the agreements about Hong Kong having a high degree of autonomy and hanging on to its way of life. I think that changed fundamentally, and we weren't to know it would happen like this with Xi Jinping, an old-fashioned Maoist who believes in the cult of personality, in controlling everything himself, is even pushing the economy in the sort of Mao direction, state-owned enterprises being the most important, private sector squeezed. And I think what's happening with COVID at the moment there is a bit sort of Maoist. So I think that we weren't to know that Xi Jinping would take over. And Xi Jinping, his first instructions to the party and government cadres were to fight what he called an intense struggle about. And then he listed all the things that you and I would regard as being fundamentals of a free society, proper historical inquiry, freedom of speech, rule of law, separation of powers. And what he was actually describing there, it's quite interesting when you look at it, was a pretty good way of talking about Hong Kong. And I think one of the reasons why he's been so ruthlessly tough on Hong Kong is that Hong Kong represents a political and intellectual challenge to the notion that Chinese communist central control will rule forever and be a very attractive thing for the rest of the world, which is, of course, nuts.
You talk about in your book a speech you made about this whole issue in 2017. Of course, that was after Xi, as we know. And you said the most difficult question after this speech was from a kid who said, "We've listened to you, Mr. Patton, but what if you're wrong? What will happen if the Communist Party starts arresting us, sending people to prison?" You know, you obviously went through all the Nelson Mandela, all the hope and dreams of democracy and how it's inevitable and this and that. But that child, or rather that young person, asked you a very relevant question.
Sure. Nowadays, I find the most difficult thing I'm asked again and again by people from Hong Kong who are in Britain, by students. There are lots at the university where I'm the chancellor at Oxford. And they say to me, should we go back to Hong Kong? And it's a most extraordinarily difficult question. I mean, there are 100,000 of them in the UK now making a huge contribution to the country, but able people, doctors, nurses, teachers, and entrepreneurs. And what do I say to them? I can express, as you've said, all those wonderful remarks of people like Nelson Mandela, that you can't lock up an idea. And I do believe that in the long run, the ideas that we represent in democracies, in open societies, will triumph over surveillance state totalitarianism, like you see in China. And I think we're also, to a considerable extent, dealing with post-peak China, just as we're dealing with post-peak Putin. But it's very difficult to give those assurances with complete conviction and to be seen to be suggesting that other people should have to be braver than I've ever been. So I find it morally really, really difficult. And I just hope that the West of the world will keep on recognizing that what Hong Kong represents is really important and fundamental to all of us.
Tell me how you describe Hong Kong right now. All these brave people have found themselves in jail. How do you describe it, and how do you see it in the next 5, even 10 years?
Well, a great international financial city, a free city, albeit not an entirely democratic one, but on the way to democracy, is being turned into a neo-police state, now run by a policeman who earned his colours, earned his house captain's colours for the Chinese by being the policeman who was responsible for the appalling policing of the demonstrations against the extradition treaty in 2019, when there were up to 2 million people on the streets. And rather than talk to people, they were dealt with tear gas and plastic baton rounds and tasers. Indeed, I was suggesting the other day that maybe the emblem of this Hong Kong, at least for the time being, should be the taser rather than the bohinia, the flower. So it's really grim. And of course, what happens is each of these leaders, while they go along with whatever their masters in Beijing want, I think everyone since I was in Hong Kong myself, each one of them has either themselves or their family had foreign passports. In the case of Mr. Li, his wife and two sons have foreign passports. Carrie Lam's husband and two sons had British passports. So you ask yourself, if they're so confident about the future, why make sure their families have got foreign passports? I mean, I'm very happy that they should want to live in Britain, but there's a sort of awful paradox about the fact that these people who are locking up kids who can't come here, although I'm trying to change that, we're trying to change that, and with some success at the moment, they're locking up kids while themselves have kids who can come here with a passport. It's worse than ironic.
You know, you have said, and you say in your book, you basically assess greed to be the West's motivating factors to relations with China and indeed Russia in terms of natural resources. We're seeing it all play out now. But you also said post-peak Putin and post-peak Xi. But it doesn't look like that from here. It looks like they are at the peak of their own ideas for the world, which are autocratic, which don't go around you know, the rule of law, and which, as we can see in Russia's case anyway, doesn't even respect international law or boundaries. How should the West deal with these countries if we're not going to divide the world into a new Cold War?
Even though China has been an accomplice to Russia's wicked behavior in Ukraine, they are in slightly different categories. Russia is very much a nation in decline, which is trying to reimagine its past again and trying to trade in grievance-soaked nationalism. If you ever ask yourself, what do you have in the house apart from a vodka and a copy of War and Peace that was actually made in Russia? Nobody has anything. We're dependent, excessively dependent on Russian oil and gas. But Russia is not a coming country. Russia has nuclear weapons, not a very good army, though a large one, and is being trounced whenever there's a fair fight in Ukraine. China's different. China is a much bigger and more important part of the global economy. And I've never thought that we should try to contain China, but I do think we should constrain China when it behaves badly. And we shouldn't be terrorized. What we should do is to stand up for our own values. Democracy, open societies are going to last much longer than totalitarian regimes, provided we stand up for ourselves, work together when we're being bullied. And unfortunately, there are some signs that we're not always prepared to stand up for democratic values. I look at what's happening in the United States. I look at what's happening in parts of Europe now, and I worry. I look at what's happening in the Republican Party in the United States and worry when I see people denying that President Biden won the election. I mean, it is not a very good signal to send about the long-term strength of democracy.
You led me right into my next question, because what about democracy in your own country? You were obviously a Tory MP for a number of years. You were chairman of the Conservative Party. But you've recently said about the current government here, we have a nationalist, populist government that is fatally not popular. You have called it the Johnson cult still hanging on, and describing this government as shameful and seedy. So we know your view here. Tell us a little bit more about it, and what can your party do?
Well, what is quite interesting is that the sort of views I've expressed have, in similar terms, not maybe with quite these sort of technicolor adjectives, but they've been expressed by, for example, two former leaders of the Conservative Party, Michael Howard and William Hague, many others. So all of them expressing a lack of confidence in the Prime Minister. Whether it will persuade him to do the decent thing, I don't know. A friend of mine who was one of his teachers at school wrote a report about him when he was 16 or 17, which has been true right through his life. He said of Boris in a note to his father, Boris thinks that it's churlish of the rest of us to not recognize that he's exceptional and that the network of obligations and duties which the rest of us have to recognize don't apply to him. And that's unfortunately been the sort of way he's lived for the last, whatever it is, 50-odd years.
And what do you think are the most at-risk elements of rule of law, human rights, a democratic nation? We know that in terms of Brexit and the Northern Ireland Protocol, this Prime Minister intends to rip up a deal that he solemnly agreed to with the EU. We know that in terms of refugees and asylum seekers, they're sending them to Rwanda, which has at the very best a questionable human rights record. What worries you about what may be coming down the pike?
Well, I tell you what worries me most, perhaps. I mean, I'm worried about all those things. It's very difficult to stand up internationally for the rule of law and for sticking to your word if you don't seem to be doing it yourself. But what really worries me is that we're going to face, I think, in the United Kingdom in the next few years, another real challenge to the United Kingdom from Scotland and maybe from Northern Ireland as well. And I think we need a government which is capable of working with others in other parties in order to put the best possible case for the union, because without it, we'd be a much depleted country, both in international terms and in economic terms.
And finally, you alluded to, you know, the strains on our political discourse and political activity, the deep divisions, the partisan nature. You said, you know, I worry for the American Republican Party, but also, as we've just described, the British Conservative Party's got its own issues. You are probably the last or one of the few of a dying breed of a moderate conservative who has, you know, much more ability to cross lines and get business done. You said recently that you're angry, and it's probably just because so many of the things that I think my generation took for granted are now being trashed. Like what?
Well, let me just say, I went into politics partly because I got involved in an American campaign when I'd just been a student in New York, working for John Lindsay, who became the mayor of New York and was originally a Republican, became an independent, became a Democrat. But when I was working in New York in a political campaign, the political representation of New York was Javits, Keating, Rockefeller. None of them would stand a prayer in a Republican primary these days. They were internationally minded. They were believed in markets, but they also believed in social responsibility. And they weren't driven by a right-wing ideology, which has no relevance to the lives most people live, which is based on trying to open up wedges between people on racial or cultural lines. And I really worry that if we allow ourselves to be torn apart by that sort of identity politics, it is going to seriously undermine our ability to work together in defending the values which have made us all the best places to live in the world.
Boy, at a time when we can really see them under attack. Lord Patton, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed. Nice to be with you again.
A sobering assessment from a veteran politician. Next, to an artist who's certainly having a moment, Michel Zorner is navigating newfound stardom, performing in the season finale of Saturday Night Live and joining Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People list. The indie rock star is also a New York Times best-selling author for her memoir, Crying in H-Mart. Here's a taste of Be Sweet from her band's new album, Jubilee. Make it up to me. Bianca Rodriguez sat down with Zorner to talk about her creative success in literature and music.
Michel, thank you so much for joining us. It's such a pleasure to have you here. Wow, we've just been talking about what an incredible year or two 2021 has been for you. And now this year, best-selling memoir, headlining musical festivals, musical act for SNL in their season finale. What has it been like for you?
It's been completely surreal and certainly very validating. You know, there were so many years put into this record and growing the band, and also this book, you know, was about a 5-year process. And so it feels incredibly validating after all that time that I've reached this level. It's very surreal.
So we'll get more into the book in just a moment. Let's talk about your musical career, because that took years to lift off, really. And you started this passion in your adolescent years in Oregon. You moved to New York, and like so many of these stories, you struggled. What kept you persisting in this field? And were there moments where you thought, you know what, maybe I should really do something different?
So many times. You know, I started playing the guitar and writing songs when I was 16 years old. So for almost, well, how long is that? 17 years. And, you know, I came from this DIY background where I would play house shows in basements across North America and drive a 15-passenger van and with my bandmates and sleep on floors at colleges and random people's houses and carrying an 80-pound amp down some rickety stairs every night. So, you know, I think that I came up in a time where, you know, that was paying your dues as an indie musician. And I really admired people that kind of came from that background, and within that community we were always sort of supporting each other, that's what you were supposed to do, and that someday it would happen for you. But there were certainly a number of occasions where, you know, the floor was particularly gross or the show was particularly dismal and not many people came. You'd get paid in like a can of soup and a few loose bills that I wanted to give up. And I certainly did give up when my mom got sick and when I was 25. And it felt like at that age it was time to move on. But then I made a record about that experience called Psychopomp that, of course, was the one that sort of took off.
Okay, so there was, we're going to play an excerpt from the song. Just want to get your response to what these words meant for you. How does it feel to stand the height of your powers?
I mean, it is a constant rush, you know? I mean, I think that this new record, Jubilee, was written after two albums and an entire book about grief and loss. And I felt like after I had completed the book, I had sort of said everything I needed to say about that experience, and it was time to begin a new chapter creatively. And so I wanted to kind of rush to the other end of the spectrum of human experience and write this album about joy. And I think part of it was this beautiful experience I was having where people were listening to my music for the first time, or I was able to pursue a career in the arts and finally being able to pay rent, and that was a real joy. And so I wanted to write an album about giving myself permission to feel joy, finally allowing joy into my life, the joys of getting to do what I do for a living, which is just a complete lottery ticket. But of course, you know, in any creative field, there is this sort of agony of just, you know, toiling away and this constant fear of rejection and misunderstanding. But then, you know, there's this other side that's just so perfect and so joyous and wonderful. And to be able to look out at a sea of people singing words you wrote back to you is such a perfect feeling that I feel so lucky to get to do every day. And so that song is sort of about the two poles of creativity, the rush of, you know, completing something that resonates with people, and also just the agony of creation and the self-doubt and imposter syndrome.
Does that feeling ever get old, the rush of performing for an audience that's singing your lyrics back to you?
It never gets old.
Yeah. Yeah, you lost your aunt, you lost your mom, you lost your grandmother, and you write about that in the book. What role, if any, and maybe intentional or not, did these women play in your both careers, both literary now and in music?
I think, I mean, certainly my mother and losing her has informed my music and my book completely, you know. I mean, before that I was pursuing both writing and music, but she has certainly been the inspiration for all of my work pretty much over the past 8 years. But I think in a way she made me really work at it. Like, she was not really supportive of my creative life, not because she didn't believe in me, but I think as a mother feels it is her duty often, she felt like it was her responsibility to sort of protect me from the financial insecurity of that type of profession, and also the emotional instability and the rejection that comes with that type of life. And so I think that she really instilled a very strong work ethic in me, that I would always have to kind of fight for this, that this was never going to come easily.
Did you find that to be judgmental? I mean, I know you talk about in the book about how she would just give you certain looks every time she saw a new tattoo, and a look that only a mother could give, right? And the response and the feeling that only a daughter could feel from their mother. What were those interactions like?
My mother was an incredibly judgmental and critical woman that, you know, especially as an only child, as an only daughter, could feel incredibly smothering. And now, in retrospect, of course, I really miss that smothering devotion. But at the time, it was completely exhausting. You know, I had such an independent streak, and I was a creative, and it felt like this woman was standing in the way of my passion and my dreams. But I think it was her way of loving and protecting me. But it, you know, it was everything. I think most parents probably aren't thrilled to see new tattoos on their children.
Who did you write this book for? Was it therapeutic for yourself in the way that some of your music had been?
I think that in all of my creative work, it's really just for myself. I think that oftentimes the personal is the most universal, and you know, it was really a way of just making sense of what had happened. It was such a whirlwind 6 months when we found out that she had stage 4 cancer. I moved to Eugene, and we went through 2 horrible rounds of chemotherapy, and then she died. I was married during that time. I left behind music during that time. It was just such a whirlwind. My whole life changed in 6 months, and so I think so much of this book was sort of just trying to make sense of that and trying to express to people what I couldn't in conversation.
And so much of this book and so much of your relationship was surrounded with food and Korean food and your love for Korean food. And you talk about the trauma you experienced after her loss and concern about the connection. Would you still have that connection with your Korean heritage, with Korean food? What have you learned out of that?
I have learned that so many, not just like mixed race people, but adoptees and, you know, people who are immigrants have this shared sort of experience. I think it's such a natural bridge to your culture. And for me, growing up mixed race and suddenly losing what kind of tethered me to that part of myself, just felt at risk suddenly in this way that I had never experienced before. And it was healing. You know, I felt for a long time I could not remember my mom before she got sick, because it was sort of the first concentrated period of time in the last 7 years that I got to spend with her after moving away from home for college at 18. And so that made me incredibly sad that all I could remember was this really traumatic, you know, period of time, and I knew my mother would not want me to remember her that way. And it wasn't until I started going to a Korean grocery store and started cooking Korean food that I had all of these really lovely memories from my childhood start to sort of break through, and I could remember my mom again and the things that we shared before illness entered our lives.
You're going to read an excerpt from the book, and I love how you describe your mom. It's not the sort of what you'd see in American households, this sort of compassionate, overly sweet, saccharine-filled mother. But your mother really expressed her love and appreciation for people through food, by knowing which foods they liked, which food they didn't, and was really proud of you for even trying novel foods. Can you read a little bit of that?
Sure. Food was how my mother expressed her love. No matter how critical or cruel she could seem, constantly pushing me to meet her intractable expectations, I could always feel her affection radiating from the lunches she packed and the meals she prepared for me just the way I liked them. I can hardly speak Korean, but in H Mart, it feels like I'm fluent.
Your mom is obviously not here with us, but I'm sure you've thought over and over again in your head how she would have reacted to this book. I know your dad had voiced some questions about some of the facts in the book. How would your mom, in your opinion, have responded to this and its success?
I always like to think that if another half-Korean girl wrote this book about her mother, my mother would read it and say in a sort of chiding way, I hope that you love me this much to write something like this. But I'm sure that if she read this book, she would find her own issues with the storytelling. But I think that she would be incredibly proud of me. I think of her all the time when I get to wear a pretty dress or do a photo shoot or carry a nice bag or wear sunscreen or all these things like that I know that she would be so proud of. And I have to think of in some way that she knows, even though it goes against every logical belief that I have.
We hear President Biden reflect on his loss in his life, and he says whenever there's a crisis, whenever there's a tragedy, a shooting, what have you, and he tells those grieving that there will come a day where the thought of the loss of their loved one will not bring a tear to their eye but a smile to their face. And I'm just wondering, when was that moment for you when the thought of your mother would bring a smile to your face instead of tears to your eyes?
Gosh, I mean, I don't know if I can pinpoint a specific moment, but I also think that I really enjoy crying for my mother. You know, I talk about it so much in interviews that sometimes when something just knocks me off my feet and brings a tear to my eye, remembering her, I'm so comforted that that's there because, you know, I feel like... I don't know who said this, but, you know, the sentiment about love or grief being love enduring, I truly believe that. And so it brings me great comfort when memories of my mother make me smile, but it also brings me great comfort that I still cry for her. because, you know, it's such a intense, raw feeling to remember her and have a small memory kind of knock you off your feet, that I think that was another chapter in my life when I was able to also just appreciate the tears, you know. I think that's another sort of level of grief that is still pretty new for me that I appreciate.
Michelle, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Such a moving conversation there about grief and family. Now to climate change in the United States and new obstacles thrown up by the Supreme Court. It has just ruled to curb the Environmental Protection Agency's ability to regulate carbon emissions. This comes amid a period of extreme weather around the world, with over 40 million Americans under heat alerts last week. Christy Ebi has been researching the health risks of climate change for decades, and she tells Hari Srinivasan that response systems must be improved to prevent more deaths.
Christian, thanks. Professor Christy Ebi, thanks so much for joining us. We just had a result from the Supreme Court that says that the Environmental Protection Agency does not have that broad authority to regulate coal-fired power plants and shift them towards cleaner sources, that they have to tailor a specific a proposition to individual power plants. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, what does this sort of a ruling do to our efforts to fight climate change?
This is, needless to say, a very disappointing ruling, and it's out of step with the understanding of the climate science. And it's out of step, frankly, with where our economy is going. We know that the number of jobs of one of the fastest growing sectors is all in renewables. The costs of renewables have dropped significantly. An announcement that got very little press was when all the major auto companies said they're going to get out of internal combustion engines. Industry's moving on. Industry understands the future needs to reduce emissions of greenhouse gases, and industry's moving towards that. We know that the coal industry is dying out in the U.S. It's no longer economical, that the cost of renewables have dropped significantly. Giving and recognizing that EPA has that authority would have helped move this transition faster. Delaying this means that we are going to continue as a nation to significantly contribute to the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. We're going to continue to damage the health and well-being of Americans and of people around the world. And it's a very disappointing ruling.
We are hearing a headline here, a headline there about, more often than not, homeless people who are dying in extreme heat conditions in the United States. And you and climate researchers around the world are telling us that this is going to be normal, that the temperatures are increasing, but that these deaths are preventable.
This is a very important issue. Our temperatures are rising. We're seeing more intense and longer heat waves. And those who are most vulnerable, including the unhoused, unless we do more to protect them, are expected to die in increasing numbers as we have these more heat waves, higher summer temperatures.
Just the other day, we had dozens of people die in the back of a trailer. They were being smuggled across the border. And again, there are lots of causes for this, but ultimately what led to their death was the heat inside that trailer. And that's not something that we heard about 10 years ago or 15 years ago, nearly at the same rates that we're hearing about today. And I'm wondering, this combined with the stories of unhoused people dying in extreme heat, is this part of what's going to be normal for us to hear as the summers get hotter?
If we don't make any changes, then yes. But we really do have to start thinking differently about our future. It is going to be hotter. And when you think about so many activities, so many policies we have, all of them were developed just assuming that the weather is constant. That is no longer the case. And people don't factor that into decisions, the human smuggling, which is just a huge tragedy in many dimensions. They don't think about the weather. They don't think about what that could mean for all those poor people in the back of that truck. So unless we can really move our policies, unless we can recognize the interconnectedness of all of our vulnerabilities, that there's, as you said, lots of reasons for human smuggling, we need to address those. We need to address ways to ensure that people can stay in their countries, which is what their preference is. We need to find ways to address multiple different challenges to our societies and recognize that climate change is a stress multiplier.
Are there specific populations that are at greater risk? Say, for example, pregnant women.
There's real risks with pregnant women. There's a growing number of studies showing that during the last period of pregnancy, and it's still being defined, during heat waves, we'll have more low birth weight babies. So babies that come early and are small then, and there can be consequences for those children for years, depending on how it's medically managed. There's also an increase in stillbirths during some periods of pregnancy. And so pregnant women do need to be protected. Outdoor workers, adults over the age of 65, children under the age of 1 physiologically can't really manage this higher core body temperature. People who take certain drugs like beta blockers or some of the psychotropic drugs reduce the ability of your body to sweat. The list is quite long, which is why we need these comprehensive plans for how to bring together all of our city services so that we can make sure that we do protect people.
Just this year, areas in India and Pakistan experienced just scorching temperatures that would be unimaginable and that would have been almost science fiction. But they're, well, living through it right now already in 2022.
That's correct. And there is a area of climate science called detection and attribution that looks at these individual events to determine the extent to which climate change could have made a difference. And we know for some of these heat waves in India, the one that we had here in Seattle a year ago, in northern Scandinavia, in Japan, that heat waves have occurred that would be virtually impossible without climate change, that these are climate change fueled events. And the climatologists tell us we're entering into a period where almost all of our extreme events are going to be made more extreme by our changing climate.
How does climate change that might be caused in some other part of the world, how is that an accelerant to a a hurricane becoming worse or a heat wave becoming worse?
When we think about the distribution of, for example, temperature in our region or the distribution that we were used to when we were growing up, it forms a nice curve. It's called a bell-shaped curve because it looks like a bell. And as we burn more of fossil fuels, we're moving the median of that, the average of that, to a higher temperature. But at the same time, that higher temperature, the shape of the curve, is coming down and flattening and going further out to the right. And we're seeing a much bigger increase in extreme events than one would have expected just because of the dynamics of the climate system and the climate system needing to do something with all this energy that we're putting into it.
So some of that energy goes back into, say, the Gulf Coast and the waters, and then those waters end up warmer, and the warmer waters are worse for those hurricanes.
You're exactly right that those higher temperatures in the oceans are driving the strength of hurricanes. We're not necessarily going to see more hurricanes, but there's going to be a change in the distribution to more intense hurricanes. Just as with precipitation, we're seeing about the same number of precipitation events, but a shift to much heavier precipitation events.
You know, as you're saying this answer, it's interesting to me because the number of hurricanes that I've covered, there usually is some sort of a plan that kicks in a few days in advance. People take it seriously. Infrastructure is moved into place or moved out of harm's way. And we don't really think of heat waves or extreme heat that way. And I guess we're willing to live with the casualties.
When we think about some of these large heat waves, for example, the heat dome in Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia, the estimates are being refined, but currently we're thinking about 1,000 excess deaths. And if we had any other kind of event that killed 1,000 people in just a few days, we would call it a mass casualty event. But we don't. We don't think about heat as the hazard it can be.
This week, King County, which houses Seattle, created kind of an extreme heat plan. And that was, I think, their first ever. Why did they have to take these steps?
We didn't have one last year when we had the heat dome. There was real efforts by King County, by the cities, to do everything they could to help protect people during the heat dome. But these systems require time to put together. When you think about all the different city services you want to have at the table, it's not just the health department or the meteorological department, but you also want the police, the fire department, EMT, your emergency departments. Who is responsible for talking with the elderly care institutes? Who are the trusted voices for the red line districts? And you start thinking of all the different services, all the different representatives. It takes a while to get everybody together and make sure that you are coordinated on a plan. For example, the city opened some cooling shelters, but how do you find out where those shelters are? How do you get to those? Are you expecting people to walk to the bus when it's 108 degrees and wait for a bus to go to a cooling shelter? Do you keep the shelter open overnight? Our temperatures at night were 80 degrees, which in June is just unheard of here in Seattle. And so making all of those decisions, making sure all of that works together requires time and requires coordination. So it's really important that cities start working on this before they have their first major heat wave so that they are prepared when it does happen.
I mean, there have been analyses that show that these extreme heat events are, they've more than doubled in the last 40 years, and that this is affecting almost a quarter of the world's population?
That's correct. And the projections are we could have a 15 to 20 fold increase in these events, depending on the extent to which we control our greenhouse gas emissions.
15 to 20 fold. Sorry. So does that just break that down for me? Are we talking about the increased likelihood of one happening or the increased frequency of it happening?
The intensity of these events are projected to increase. So if you look at a 1 in 50 year heat wave, so a heat wave you'd expect about 1 every 50 years, what we saw back in the Middle Ages would occur 15 times more often. And we're seeing even more extreme events. A few years ago, there was a heat wave in Scandinavia, and the Swedish Meteorological and Hydrological Institute said that this was a 1 in 3 million year event, which is pretty hard to wrap your head around, that these events are so extreme, it's hard for us to imagine.
And considering that this is a global problem, this is, and the bulk of the carbon that's released into the air is happening from industrialized nations at the United Nations level or the climate conference level. What's happening to try to mitigate some of the effects that are disproportionately going to be felt by poorer countries?
Under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change are four different funds that the high-income countries put money into to help with adaptation, which is trying to do things like put in place early warning systems, also to help people in terms of agriculture, water, a whole range of issues, and also to help low and middle income countries reduce their burning of fossil fuels, of oil and gas and coal. One of the challenges we see in health, when you look across those funds, less than 0.5% of those funds have gone towards health, that the majority of the funds have gone towards the significant challenges we're facing in food and water security, which is critically important. But we also need that investment in health. And there is starting to be a shift under those adaptation funds to put more funding into the health challenges so we don't have people suffering and dying in heat waves.
Now, I know that the UN had cut some of the climate aid to poor countries. What kind of impacts is it going to have? Because as you mentioned, it takes a while for a dollar to translate into policy on the ground.
As you said, the low and middle income countries, for most of them collectively, have very low emissions of greenhouse gases. 80% of our emissions come from just 20 countries. And so these countries are coming into the convention and very appropriately saying, we're suffering. In the language used under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, this is loss and damage, that they're suffering losses and damages, and it's not their fault. They didn't emit these greenhouse gases, and they are collectively have a strong voice in they need to have more funding to help them manage the kinds of crises they're facing because of climate change that they didn't cause.
Do you think that there's any sort of a moment that can impress upon the richer countries the responsibility that they have?
There's a couple different answers to that. First is one of the changes I've seen over the last 15 years is climate change is no longer within a country's Ministry of the Environment. It's now all of country issue. It's a security issue for many countries. And so this becomes a different kind of negotiation. And so one hears stories about countries like the US going and talking with countries saying, here's some goals we'd like to achieve. And the response from the country is, you need to talk with us about climate change. And so it's coming in at a very different level. The second is it can be discouraging looking at what's going on at the national level. And I encourage people to look subnationally at all the cities that have set their goals for adaptation and for mitigation. All that's going on subnationally, all that's going on in our businesses. There is so much change, positive change going on. And to pay attention to that positive change and contribute to it is going to help move our politicians at the national level further forward.
Professor Christy Ebi from the University of Washington, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for covering this.
And finally tonight, letting nature do its thing. That's the strategy of Riverside Park in New York City. 20 goats have been introduced to munch on weeds that have invaded the area. Usually, this would require chemical sprays. But in a much more nature-friendly way, the hungry goats are happily eating up the weeds, even those that are poisonous to humans. They're also particularly suited to the sloping ground, which park staff struggle to access. The unusual visitors have attracted their fair share of spectators, and four of the goats will stay in the park for the rest of the summer, chomping their way to a vastly improved location for everyone else. And that is it for now. Remember, you can always catch us online on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.